I am Selwyn Jones, the uncle of the late George Floyd. In my nephew's case, in his death, he didn't have a choice. But with COVID-19, we do.
Hi, I'm Shelley Clark White of The Honeycomb and co-host of the sensational podcast, That's My Story. While we all understand the discomfort of wearing a mask and receiving a vaccine, please recognize at this present time, the only solution to fighting this deadly virus is being vaccinated and wearing a mask, because we cannot afford to do nothing.
Hello, my name is Lorelei McBroom. I'm a professional singer. I've worked with Pink Floyd, the Rolling Stones, Nile Rodgers, and presently with the McBroom Sisters. The facts are 99.5% of all COVID deaths are among those who are unvaccinated and who refuse to wear a mask.
Hi, and I'm Ken Knox of the group, chairman of the board and co-host of the awesome podcast, That's My Story. So why play Russian roulette with your life and those of your family? COVID is real and it is on the rise. It is not going away unless we as a society together save society.
And I'm Stephen Davis, the host of the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. That means that at this time in history, getting vaccinated and wearing a mask for all of society is all important. The life you may save not only will be your family's and yours, but more importantly to me, my family and mine.
Do us a favor. Get vaccinated. Wear your mask, please.
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Hi, I'm Stephen Davis, host of the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. On this week's episode, my guest is tall, tempting, and talented Poochie Amanda Jones, jazz singer extraordinaire. Welcome, Poochie. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you so much for being here. I want to go all the way back to your childhood. Where were you born at? And who were your parents? Tell me something about your parents.
Let's see. I was born in North New Jersey at City Hospital. My father is from Georgia. He's now gone. And my mother was from Alabama. And they actually migrated to the city, met, fell in love, and produced three kids. And I'm the middle one.
You're the middle one. You're the one who had the, you must have had a problem with an older and a younger, and everybody's trying to ignore you.
It's something because my sister's a doctor and my brother's a business person. So I'm the prodigal child. I'm the one that didn't get married with the white picket fence and the 2.3 kid. I'm the troublemaker. The one that is so interesting because my mother, when I was three years old, walk in the streets. And my mother used to spank me and say, don't go across those streets. And I would do it anyway. So I was the child that was hard of hearing.
That's what you call it. Okay, I'm going to use that myself.
Obeying. I have a child. I had her at a young age.
Yeah, but I don't want to get you yet because we're not finished with your childhood.
Oh, well, okay.
So, you know, you tell me about school. What school did you go
to? I went to Wake High School. I went to West Kinney Street School. I went to Cleveland High School. I went to Cleveland Elementary and 18th Avenue Elementary.
Okay. Then, now, in what city?
Newark. Everything was in Newark, New Jersey.
So you went there. How were you as a student?
Horrible. I didn't listen. I remember I had one favorite teacher. His name was Mr. Edmund, and he was my math teacher. And he would always tell me that you're going to make it. You're going to make it. And then I had a horrible teacher, which I can't remember her name. It was a white woman, and she had two twin daughters that went to the school. And basically at that time, corporal punishment was allowed. And this woman did not like the look of me whatsoever. And she used to break the ruler in my hand because they could hit us back then. So I'm dating myself. And most of my school years was spent in the coat closet looking through the vents. You know, what's so interesting, I think that's why I like being alone now, because they pre-trained me, you know?
Did you get through high school?
Oh yeah, I graduated from high school. And then I went on to several colleges, Essex County College, Cranford College in Union. And then I moved to Los Angeles at a young age. It was like the Fresh Prince of Bel Air, where your parents just say, maybe you just do.
And you were near Philadelphia too. Huh?
Maybe a new environment would help. And I went to Los Angeles City College, Santa Monica City College, and then I went to the Fashion, before I did that, then I came back and I went to the Fashion Institute of Technology. And then after my mother died, I finally settled down to decide what I wanted to do. And I graduated from the New School University in 1996. Hmm. But I was going to be a professional student as long as I could be.
What were you doing at the same time? Were you just able to be freewheeling and not have a job?
Yeah, I did. I did venture off to Paris. I used to hang out at the garage. I was about 5'10 at 12 years old. So I grew up quickly. I developed quickly at 12 years old. Now, the girls at 12 years old was like I was back in the day. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have the capacity of a teenager, but I had the body. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of things and lied about my age when I was younger. Because if you talk to me, you would say, you said you are how old? 19? Really? But I think at 14, I was saying I was 19. I was one of those kids.
Uh-huh. Were you a leader or were you a follower?
I was always a leader. Leos are always leaders.
You are Leo. What month?
August the 11th.
August the 11th.
Double ones. And we're stopping right there.
Now, when you were in Paris, how long were you in Paris for?
Off and on for about 4 years. I love Paris.
At that time, were you into your singing?
No, I was actually modeling. And it was so ironic because I was too tall. I got to do about 3 or 4 shows and that was it. I was always too tall. Mm-hmm. And you would think that being tall and thin, I went to Paris weighing about 119 pounds, maybe 20, at 6'1". That was too tall for a Black woman back in the
day. Really?
Yes. Now they're trees with branches, but back in the day, no. I remember, and this was the highlight, when I got to walk for, see his name escapes me, but walking down on an auditioning, it was Valentino, walking and auditioning for him, he thought I was great, but I was too tall. So I did a lot of whatever I could in Paris, but it was fun. I fell in love in Paris every time I went.
It just is funny that as we will talk about it later on about you being a jazz singer, and you always picture, especially tall Black women, sultry tall Black women in Paris. That's just a wonderful time in terms of being a singer.
It was after my mother died. See, a lot of things transformed after my mother died in 1991. My mother always wanted me to sing because my father was a jazz a blues musician who taught himself the piano, played the harmonica, and he was just phenomenal. And after, I'm jumping ahead, after my mother died, we got to meet my father's family, and everybody in his family could sing and play an instrument. My mother was the dominant factor when we were growing up. I really didn't know my father's family until after my mother died.
And what was your father and your mother's name?
Wooten.
Introduce them to us.
Okay. So my mother was Beatrice Ann Terrell, and then she married Horace Wooten. And my father was Horace Luke Wooten, W-O-T-E-N.
There used to be, in Brooklyn, there used to be a councilwoman named Priscilla Wooten.
I don't know her.
Maybe y'all are related.
There is a musician and his name is Wooten. And I reached out to him. What was so interesting is when we went to Georgia, I'm going to say Macon, Georgia. And it was so interesting to see so many white Wootens. And the Wootens had a store. And the Wootens had a trucking company. That kind of shocked me to see so many white Wootens. What was so interesting is that we went into this store to help my father to buy something. And he was being waited on by a Wooten, a white man. And to me, that was shocking. And I said, oh, you must have been the slave owners. And my father told me to shut up.
I did a couple of years ago had lunch with one of the descendants of that my family came from.
Ah.
We had lunch right here in New York on 60-something Street. And it was an interesting time.
It's interesting because growing up in a predominantly Black community, and I was an adult then, and just seeing so many white Wootens, to me, Wooten is that red eye gravy over macaroni and cheese and chitlin banana, if you know what I'm talking about.
But I think it's because that's what we were used to, because we didn't know that a great deal of our family members took the names of the slave owners when they left the plantation. And I know that there's a town in South Carolina that's named after, quote, I thought they were named after my relative, but they were named after white folk. And that's where they grew up around.
Yeah. So
you knew that had to be what happened in terms of them sticking around and then using the name of Bowman. That's interesting.
That was interesting. And the Terrells, which was my mother's name, I always thought the fighter, I forgot his first name,
Ernie Terrell.
Yeah, I just thought he was related to us.
But his sister Terrell was a singer.
Yes, I thought she was. There's probably some relationship down the corridor. It had to be.
Well, one of the things that you do find, because I did a lot of research on my own family, I have 1,500 plus people on my ancestry tree. And there were some who stayed in the vicinity of the nucleus of where the family got their freedom at. But as the war started happening, World War I and stuff, you'll find some came to the big cities and stayed after they got out of the army because they weren't going back to the farm. And there were like in finding all of a sudden, they decided that they wanted to go out in California.
Mm.
It's you would have been the one to say, hey, I'm tired of South Carolina or Georgia. Let's go out to California.
Yeah. Moving on out.
Yes. So that happened a lot. How did you make the transition from being on the catwalk as a model to becoming a jazz vocalist?
From the catwalk, when I was in California, I worked as an actress. I'm affiliated with SAG-AFTRA and Equity for over 30 years. And that was interesting because I auditioned with the best, but I was always too tall. See, I had an audition with Denzel back in the day. I'm here and he's here. We were starting out. A lot of work I didn't get because I was tall, taller than the average person. I am in a Rudy Ray Moore movie, Disco Godfather and the Whack Attack. I played, and you know, so interesting, Cliff Rockmore, you have to Google him. He was a superb producer, Black man. I even studied with Bill Dukes. I even studied with him. And when he cast me for the Rudy Ray Moore film, I figured, okay, this was my way to start him. It wasn't, because if you look at the Rudy Ray Moore documentary, he got things done in his own way. In his own way. So that was my first starring role. And then I got to do two episodes of Hill Street Blues, which was fabulous because I can't think of her last name, but she dug me. And every time I audition, I even auditioned in front of Stanford Brown, I think his name is. He was married to the woman who played in Cagney and Lacey.
Okay.
And it was phenomenal because they would give me bit parts.
His name was George Stanford Brown.
Yes, George Stanford Brown. So they dug me. And then all of a sudden, the casting directors, Jerry Wims, got married. That was it. I even did Johnny Carson. I was with the Johnny Carson Mighty Art Players.
How long were you with them?
Just one season. And I only got to do three skits, which I cannot find on the internet. And then I got to do the Jeffersons, but I auditioned a lot. And the problem was
I had the same problem. Mm. My height prevented me from going on the Boston Celtics or the Los Angeles Lakers. I really wanted to be a New York Knick, but they wasn't taking people that was under 4 feet at that time. You know, I would have been between Bill Russell's legs. So I could understand missing out on that job.
You're good, but you're too tall.
But
you're too tall. And that was the problem. You're good.
The theme of my show is progress despite obstacles. Mm. Now, evidently, your tallness was an obstacle, but you overcame.
Even when I dated, I was here and they were there, and God forbid if I put on heels, because then I was there. Well, you can't, and they still were here.
but there's a cadre of men that love tall women with long legs. And the shorter they are, the more they love it.
Life, and I have to say this, the love of my life is when I dated Bernie Casey. He was the absolute joy. There was no
tell the audience who Bernie Casey was.
Oh, Bernie Casey was with the Raiders, LA Raiders, and he was also an artist, and he painted beautiful pastel flowers, became an actor. And he died, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. But I dated Bernie up until the time he did the last installment with Sean Connery of 007.
Oh, okay.
And so you're away for a year. Yeah, he did.
I'm sure you all remain friends over years.
That's showbiz. The period on.
Okay, let's continue on your life journey.
Okay, what do you want to be?
You had an acting period. You were on a number of shows. You had a problem with that because of your tallness. Your height.
And I looked too much like Donna Summer at the time. That was another thing. I remember I was a casting director for a McDonald's commercial. Mm-hmm. And they wanted young Black girls. And at this point, I was working at John Robert Powers. So I brought all of my students to this audition, and they saw every last one of them. And when they came in, they said, "We need to talk to you." And at that time, my hair was, I was wearing a long Farrah Fawcett wig. Mm-hmm. back in the day. They said, can you take off your wig? Yeah. And I took it off and my hair was pulled back. And they said, you're the person we're looking for. And I got the gig.
That was like the malt shop that they used to have in Los Angeles, the shop where all these women were discovered.
Yes, it was at the drugstore.
It was your drugstore moment.
That was interesting. So I was working for John Robert Powers right across the street from that famous drugstore. And one of Barry Gordy's brothers, who was working with Tina Marie at the time, came up to the school because I was the youngest Black director that John Robert Powers, was a modeling and self-development school, had. And I want to say, oh God, his name escapes me, but I will remember. And he says, you know what? We're looking for backup singers for Tina Marie. And that was I almost had his name. It was right here. And I dropped it. And that was the same thing with Magic Johnson, because Magic Johnson at the time had some sort of speech impairment at that time. They were looking for elocution lessons. And it was Magic Johnson and Jackie Joyner Kersee, which was really cool because at the time, back in the day, they were looking for Black people to help Black people. And my name was out there. And that was really cool, even though I didn't get to meet Jackie nor Magic Johnson, but I did get to meet Tina. Through my years, I've done a lot.
You seem to be very much of a survivor.
Seen a lot, done a lot. I've been on that roller coaster of life where I was started here and then it says zoom and it got stuck. Mm-hmm. It just didn't want to come up. And then, damn, you're stuck again. So, yeah, I've seen a lot. Yeah.
Now you are talking about, you did say that again?
His name was Fuller Gore. I was helping young Black women from the inner city area on grace and charm and beauty and etiquette and things of that nature. So the school that John Robert Powers Modeling and Self-Development School, it was like Barbizon. The beauty of it is because inner city kids have a lot of talent. Look at all of the rappers that came out of the muck and mire to be billionaires and millionaires, and like LL and 50 and Cool Diddy and P-Source and whatever their names are. Just think about what they're doing. So at the time, they were coming to a Black woman for Black sources.
That was great.
Yeah.
That was great.
And let me tell you this, Chocolate Chip Productions, the first NAACP Image Awards was produced by Chocolate Chip Productions, which they hired me to do the modeling portion and the award portion. And it was the first time that it wasn't televised, but it was the first time that Chocolate Chip Productions put on this elaborate affair. And then years later, it began to be televised and I wasn't even invited.
You weren't invited? Shame on them.
Women, nope, not at all. And I think it was because of us that it became the mega thing that it is now. Also, I have a friend by the name of Janice Maxiel, and her organization was called BIMBO, Blacks in the Media Broadcast Organization. We used to get together and picket The Price is Right. Every white show that didn't have a Black face, that's somebody you'd be interested in talking to. Janice Maxiel. She was ahead of her time in the late 70s, early 80s. We picket the Academy Awards, because at that time, they didn't have any Black presenters. Janice Maxiel, which after this, I'm going to turn you on to her. That woman was ahead of her time. And the way that I met Janice, and we're born on the same day, the way that I met her, she was having an open thing at Red Fox Studio. And it was in a casting magazine. And I went there, and it was about 100 girls. And we were all waiting for whatever was supposed to happen, to my recollection. And the person never came. So I went to Janice and I said, I could work for you. And she said, what can you do? And I said, watch me. And what I did was, okay, you all saw me standing in line, but I'm actually the person that you're waiting to see. Hang on all you girls to see what you have. And that's how my relationship started with Janice. And we've been friends for 40 years.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Oh. Yes. That's how my relationship started with Janice.
Now, this was done down out in
Los Angeles.
How long were you in Los Angeles?
I went to Los Angeles. I migrated to Los Angeles. Oh, God, I think I was about 18 and a half. Mm-hmm. And I got into a car with a friend, and we drove to Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles for about 10 years. I lived in Compton at first, and then I moved to, oh God, Hammond. I lived on Hammond. I moved up to West Los Angeles, right down the street from the Roxy, Disco 9000. And as a matter of fact, Paul, they made a movie, which you can Google this, about Disco 9000. And I lived right next door to Huggy Bear, Antonio Fargas. I was in the middle. Antonio Fargas was on one side, and oh God, what? And it was a gospel sister and brother. Oh goodness, I can't remember.
The Winans?
No, not the Winans, but they were black. Anyway, I was sandwiched between them. Sandwich. Mm. Did I just say sandwich? Andre was his first name. And his sister's name was Sandra.
Crouch.
Yes. I lived in the middle between Andre and Huggy Bear. And it was so interesting. And the things that, now it was called Boys Town. Mm-hmm. But the things that I saw and the celebrities that, which I'm not gonna mention names, baby dropping off boys in the car. The first time I saw, which I can say this, Cotton Comes to Harlem, St. Jean, Raymond St. Jean. I was in love with Raymond St. Jean. And my friend took me to this party. And I was shocked to know that Raymond St. Jean was gay. I called my mother crying. And he's gay. Didn't know he was gay. And that
But we say, just like the Seinfeld show says, not that there's anything wrong with that.
But you know, on the other side, but when you're young and on the other side, and all of a sudden you see the man that you're in love with, because I was in love with so many people. But no, there was nothing wrong with it. I was just shocked. Uh-huh. But there was a lot, and people weren't coming out at then. Like they're coming.
I do remember that. I understand that.
Yeah, but yeah, I was shocked.
What prompted you to leave Los Angeles?
I was chased out by Joan Collins.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Oh God, Joan Collins was going through a divorce with Peter Holmes. And at this point, I had a business. Dr. Samuel, I can't remember his last name, opened up this school called the Rossmore School of Modeling and Self-Development, because he said it was time for me to have my own school, because I was working for, and he was from Africa, I was working for John Robert Powers. So he opened up this establishment, made me Queen Mother B. So at one point, and this is a true story, I was in safe, shopping. I had to remember the name of the store. And I'm looking at an Inquirer magazine as I'm getting ready to pay for my food. And I see Joan Collins kicks out her husband, Peter Holmes, for cheating on her. So about, let's say, a week later, this British guy comes to the school and says, my client, this is a true story, I'm not making this up, is looking to invest in a school or invest his money in a business. And we know of your school because at that time they were doing videos and they were using some girls from the school, the business that I had, and their music videos. So I said, well, super, I would like to meet your client. He says, fine. I said, I'll have Dr. Sam come in. He says, no, basically we would invite you up to my client's home and Claire, and you could meet. And I said, wow, Bel-Air, he has some money. So the doctor said, I can't come with you, but you go. Got in my car like a week later, and I drove up to this beautiful home. And Bel-Air. Right. So I get out of my car, the maid opens the door, and I walk in, and it's, wait a minute. And I'm looking at this guy standing before me. I said, wait a minute, you're Peter Holmes. I was just reading about you. You're Joan Collins' husband. And I started laughing and he started laughing. And it was the funniest thing that a week before I'm reading about you and now I'm sitting in front of you. So the guy was there, his lawyer, and he says, yes, we're looking to invest some money into a school. You should tell us about your school. And I did. And then the next day, I get a call. Would you like to come to dinner? Yeah, at the home. And I'm thinking, okay, he's interested. So we have dinner on the terrace. Now, let me just tell you, this was simply beautiful. Okay. Eileen, would you like to come to dinner again? And I'm saying, wait a minute now. So to make a long story short, I came to dinner again, nothing happened. Then he had this party and he invited me to the party. And when I got there, he said, I thought you were never gonna come. And so, yeah, it's a party. And then he announced me as his girlfriend. And it hit the Inquirer wildflowers.
Really?
Yes. I got a copy of it. And then it's okay. That's interesting. And I was used as a pawn. See, in LA, they'll use
How did he decide on you? Did you ever find out? What made him choose you?
I never. Anyway, but then we had a relationship. So this blossomed into a relationship. Mm-hmm. Whereas he actually came to my house and I was going back to his house. And then they went to court and the story hit the Inquirer and then it hit this London paper. And then all of a sudden it's all over everywhere. Whereas Shamari, and his name was Shamari, that I had to hire a bodyguard because every time I left out of my house, there were reporters and things. I should have made some money. I got publicity, but it just got out of hand where it was like, sweet, my nickname is Sweetie, you need to come home for a minute. And that was my mother. She's like, yeah. Because this is really getting out of hand. Just come on home. And we broke off our relationship, whereas it was overwhelming. It was overwhelming. And I came home. And 9 months later, maybe less than 9 months later, my mother died. January 1st, 1991.
That's your turning point.
Yeah.
You talked about. That's that. That was your turning point. After all that happened, and then your mother died right behind you.
January 1st, 1991.
Who died first, your mother or your father?
My mother. She was 65.
Did that bring you closer together with your father, or were they still together?
Oh yeah, and that's so interesting because I guess back in the day, Black families were not used to having a mother and father at the table. And people would always ask me, is your mother still with your father? Is your father there? Yeah, there's a family unit. Yeah, it was there. It brought me closer to being suicidal because my mother was my rock. And what's so interesting about this is that she was a nurse and she had contracted asbestos poisoning. As a matter of fact, this was just a combination of things that had happened in the hospital that she worked with, which was Irvington General. And most of her colleagues were dying years before for her because of this asbestos problem. They were taking out asbestos in the hospital, and a lot of people contracted asbestos poisoning and died. And Mama survived it maybe 10, 15 years. It didn't get her, but when it got her. And what was so interesting about her death is that I knew my mother was going to die January the 1st. That was so spooky about it. That I had this woman, she was a reader. And I had this dream that my mother was going to die January the 1st. And I went to this reader who was in, and I still got the cassette tape. I still got it. And I guess she was a fortune teller, or whatever you call, a spiritualist. And I said to her, we had a reading December 27th, 1990. And I left my mother's house for this reading. No, it was December 28th. I left my mother's house for this reading. So I came home and I was preparing myself for the reading. And I got in the bed and I took all my clothes off. Because I wanted to be pure. I'm going to start crying. I don't want to cry. Just give me a second. I got in the bed. I turned on the cassette. And I said to her, I had this dream that my mother died January the 1st. So she said, oh, your mother's not going to die on January. She says, you don't have to worry about that. And I said, is God trying to punish me or is God trying to teach me something? Because I feel this. And she said, no. So on that day, my mother always had a party January the 1st. Always had a party. And I was looking forward towards the party and I went and bought beautiful napkins and I was going to bring over food. But on that day, I went jogging with my friend, Kenny Williams, and I always jog. And normally we would do all of Central Park and it would take us about 2.5 hours, maybe 3, to run 6 miles. So on this day, we did the park in 45 minutes, the whole park. And I said to Kenny, damn, Kenny, we're like, phew. And I said, someone's carrying me. And the sun was so freaking bright. And we're moving. And I said, Kenny, wow. And I kept saying, someone's carrying me. So when I got home, my answering machine was beeping. And it's, oh, shit. And it kept beeping. And I pushed it. And my brother said, sweetie, call home. And I said, Mama's dead, isn't she? And he said, yes.
How did you get along with your brother and sister?
We're good. Yeah, we're good. My sister, who's a doctor, I will not allow anyone to do anything unless they talk to her first. My sister is the smartest woman I know on this planet. And when I say she's a doctor, she's really a nurse practitioner. When I tell you how smart this Black woman is, and when she's talking to doctors on my behalf, she'll go, and they'll say, what medicine do you practice? And she says, no, I'm a nurse practitioner. But the way that she talks to them, they're like shocked. My mother just didn't have enough money to send her to med school. Mm-hmm. And my dream was always to make enough money to go on to send her to med school. But that Black woman and her husband just died, and they were together for 54 years. And her husband just died June 8th.
And this is to your family, you and your family.
That kind of broke me because he was my favorite brother-in-law. And it was so interesting that the day that he died, the spirit said, I had did a FaceTime with him. And the spirit said, call your brother-in-law. And I said, okay, I picked up the phone because now I've learned how to listen to that inner voice. Because there's been things in my life where the inner voice said, do this. And I didn't do it. And the consequences, whew, picked up the phone, called my brother-in-law. I'm coming to see you. As a matter of fact, we actually FaceTime. I said, I'm coming to see you. July 4th, I'm going to cook. It's going to be vegan because that's what I am. And he laughed. I said, yeah, my brother, I can't wait to put my arms around you and see you. And he smiled. He said, yeah, I'll see you on the 4th of July. 2 hours later, that was it. My sister called me and said, he's gone. But the spirit said, call your brother-in-law. I listened to that inner voice now. It doesn't do me wrong. It guides me. I'm not a religious person. I'm a spiritual person. I've been a Hare Krishna, a Buddhist, Muslim, where I didn't believe in God, an atheist. I've been everything. And now Jesus Christ is my savior. I'm there now. I'm cool with that. But it took me a long time to be cool with that.
Okay. Now, let's talk about, we still haven't gotten to the part about you being a jazz vocalist. But I started this show off talking about the jazz vocalist extraordinaire.
Okay. So let me tell you how I segue into that. After Mama died, she always wanted me to sing. So basically I said, I want Mama to hear my voice. So I started singing. Lafayette Harris Jr. Glenn Pearson was my first piano player. Jackie Terrison, who is the Jackie Terrison now. I've worked with so many cats. And it was so easy for me to get into it because I know so many people, and I said, okay, I want to start singing. And the genre of music that I'm in love with is jazz. And that's because of my uncle Andrew. He would always bring jazz albums to the house and listen to Miles Davis and Coltrane and Bud Powell. And he would always play these albums. And the first album that I got was Carmen McRae as a gift. Carmen McRae, Just a Little Loving, Early in the Morning, Beats a Cup of Coffee for starting off the day. And the second one was Charlie Erlin, More Today Than Yesterday. And I used to listen to Frankie Crocker. And on his show, at the end of his show, he used to play this song called Flamingo. So it just got me into listening to the music. I never was a gospel singer. My mother used to say, sweetie, and that's my nickname, go to church and learn how to sing. And I would say, Mama, I don't want to use God. I don't want to go to church. And I don't want to be in the choir because then I'm using God and God's going to punish me. So I don't want to do that. So I wasn't trained in church at all. So just listening to them and knowing the genre of music that I wanted to play, it was easy for me to get into the scene. Now, let me say in the beginning, I was, as Lafayette said, you're just a chick singer. I didn't know what key, I didn't know what key it is in, but I have a history of music. You could play two notes of a tune and I could tell you, oh, that's Freddie Hubbard. Oh, that's Red Clay. So that's how much I listened to the music. Lafayette Harris had the guts to insult me, which was very good. Very good. Because I asked him a silly question. I was rehearsing with him, which I don't rehearse anymore because I've been playing with my guys for about 25 years. So we hit the stage like this. And I said, how do you know what key that is? And he looked at me if to say, you dumb bee. That, and he didn't say it. But the way he looked at me, he said, and he looked me in the eyes, he said, because I took time to go to school and learn. And the way he looked at me is, wow, never let another man talk to me like that. So I went to school.
Now, you went to school. I was just getting ready to ask.
I have a Bachelor's of Fine Arts degree from the New School, and I have an AA from Manus College of Music. Because he was right. Just the way that he looked at me, if you want to learn this music, then you should go to school and learn the music. And I'm glad that he looked at me like that. $150,000 later, I'm still paying back. I'm still giving away. Some of the cats that I met in school was just, wow. That helped me go through the transition. Reggie Workman. Oh, God. And some of the young cats that I met. I sat down in a class with Larry Willis. I mean, it was just extraordinary to meet so many musicians in school, that Buster Williams, you know, who played with Sarah Vaughan. Sarah Vaughan gave him the bass that he used. And Reggie, who worked with John Coltrane. Being at the New School, I was the oldest school student, and I graduated finally, and I graduated with a 4.0 grade average. And it is so interesting because Bilal, I don't know if you know who Bilal is. Bilal, whew, young cat coming up and could sing. And we would be in a class, and it was 17, 18. Just don't worry about it. I'll tell you the answer because I got this. So, right, it was like, no. Kenyatta Beasley, Robert Glasper played my recital. So I was in the New School when these cats were coming up and they just blew up. They just blew up. And it's God puts me in the right place sometimes at the right time, not all the time. Sometimes he puts me in the wrong place at the right time to educate my butt. But it was just phenomenal being in the New School with these guys. And then I've been knowing Kenny Barron all my life. So my first album called Sweet Dreams, dedicated to my mother, I had Kenny Barron on piano. I had Hilliard Green on bass. I had Dwayne Cook-Bordnax on drum. I had Casey Benjamin, badass musician now, on alto. I had Kenyatta Beasley on trumpet. And it was a success. WBGO played it all the time. And I got a record company to put it out. And then I started getting gigs out of the country. And it was easy. One thing, which is so interesting, I worked in Russia. I worked in Switzerland. I worked in Paris. I worked in Singapore. I worked in Japan. I worked in Bangkok. I said Switzerland. I haven't worked in Germany. I haven't worked in Italy. I could barely work in my own country. Now, go figure. I think it has something to do with the name Poochie. which is a nickname, like Sweetie, which is there. But yes, I have worked at Birdland and I have worked at the Blue Note. But most of the gigs that I have are not in my own country. And I say sometimes that's amazing that people appreciate my talent in other countries. When I went to Istanbul, wow. And I worked at the Q Jazz Club, that was freaking phenomenal. Even when I worked in Russia, 17 city tour, and they hired me from the internet. And his name is Daniel Kramer, and he brought in Polish musicians, a bass player and a drummer. We all met on the stage. And some of the videos that you see, which, you know, I'm more than happy to send you a cartload of videos. And he said to me, he said, if the Russians don't like you, they're not gonna applaud for you. They won't like you. So we met on the stage, traveling, and our first gig, when I got off the plane, I was shuttled into a train. I met the maestro, I call him the maestro. We were on a train for about 10 hours and we got to the location. I'm gonna do everything and see, because I don't know how you sound. I don't know how you sound, but I'm gonna do everything and see. So I did the Book of Duke Ellington. Because that's easy. That's like jazz 101. Baby, they stood up for me. It was my first standing ovation. And I told them, I said, I know what I'm doing, thanks to Lafayette. I am not a chick singer. Follow me. I got this. 17 cities. They were like, and I'm going to send you one video that I started to breathe the song. And they're like, bravo. They made me feel so good that the man that hired me, I think, got a little jealous.
What's great about this interview is that questions that I would ask you, you answer before I ask them. And I love it. That's great, riveting story.
But it was just... because the stories are true. It's a continuation. And I'm living to go back because it was fun. And let me tell you about the rush. We played places equivalent to Carnegie Hall. Our first tour was small, like 500 people, 600 people to 1,500 people. And then they had me on a show like the Today Show. And they were putting the mic in my face. And the man who hired me was like sitting, are you ready for it? And I'm like animated. And I'm so happy. It's like, yeah. So we did one show at this place. And when I came off stage, the woman was talking to the maestro. And I call him the maestro. And she said, oh yeah, we would like her in her accent back next year. And I walked over and I said, I'll be more than happy to come back next year. And he said something in Russian.
That sounds like James Brown with Bootsy Collins. I said, oh, you got to go.
Right.
You're
right.
Too good.
You got to go. I haven't been back since. I said, I'm gonna make you love me. And that's what turns me on. I like having fun. And when I'm having fun, you're having fun. I am not the kind of singer that's gonna show you my ability that I could scat. Cause you don't know my records. I'm not Dee Dee Bridgewater. You don't know what I do, but there's one thing. I'm gonna walk away making you have that ultimate orgasm that I could give you of having fun. Amen.
What's in the future for you?
My book, Next Stop Beverly Hills, hopefully will finally come out. I do have a publisher out of London. And I think it's the timing. And I'm a real estate broker. There's actually a building named after me. And I got into real estate.
What building?
It's called the Amanda Condominiums, 32 West 128th Street. And the reason the building was named after me is because the developers started building stuff in Harlem. And I had this building on 109th and Madison Avenue. And the developer couldn't sell diddly because at that time, it was a lot of drug activity. The corner store was the pit stop where you can get drugs. And they gave it to me. It's like, give it to the Black girl. Baby, the Black girl employed some of the drug dealers. And I said, I need to sell this building. So here, when I have an open house, can you just disappear? And then the people that were hanging out on the street bought them a white shirt, pair of pants, gave them some money. I said, I want you to be my doorman. And they would say, hey, Amanda. They wrote about me in a magazine called The Real Deal. The man had the property for almost 9 months at 1690 Madison Avenue. Let me tell you, within 90 days, girlfriend had about 5 sales. I sold out the building within 120 days. But let me tell you what happened with that. I was good. So now you have undeveloped areas where there's things going on. So the way that the Amanda Condominiums came about is that right across the street, there was a drug rehabilitation center. And what the beauty of that was, the developers set me down after knowing what I did on 109th and Madison and said, well, help us create a building that will sell. It was only 5 units. I said, keyed elevator, opens right, they don't do this anymore. High ceiling, terraces, give them something that I call the wow effect, that when they walk in, they say, wow.
Wow.
Let me tell you what happened. They did their, and I was working for Douglas Elliman at the time. They did the Amanda Condominiums and named it after me, which was named after my grandmother, because I got my name from my grandmother. Douglas Elliman, and I'm going to say this, and I don't care if you keep it. Basically, what happened was, when you bring a developer into the fold, every project that he does is your project. They took him away from me when they built on 98 and 3rd. Same building. And I asked them, why did they do that? Oh, because you don't know the area. You're talking about the roller coaster ride of discrimination that I've been on. And then they built in the village. Oh, you don't know the area. I don't know the area because I'm Black. Yeah, I know the area. I know it quite well. I was so disappointed. And then I got away from real estate for a while, because what happened was I became Douglas Elliman's first VP. Now we're governed under REBNY, the Real Estate Board of New York. I made $100,000 in a year. So that qualified me to be a VP. And basically I was kicking butt and taking no names. And my colleagues didn't want to come to Harlem. So Amanda, here, let me give you this business and I'll give you 25%. You just refer me to give me 25%. Baby, when they saw how much money I was making, let me tell you, they kicked me. O-U-T.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, there was one situation where I named the building. I worked on the building for 8 years. When we had the down market, I brought the developers back in the fold. I sat with Gene Kaufman, and these are names that you can Google, and the developers. I created a building called The Style on East 131st and 32nd. Everything. And the developers of the building decided, after they raped me of my talent, they gave it to another brokerage firm of the same religious background. I was suicidal. And I'm giving, because I could not believe that you took my talent, and I was off to Bangkok singing and having fun because I knew that now the building is going up. I couldn't have fun. I need to come back and make some serious money. But they allowed me just to go off to Bangkok for 3 years because it takes a long time to get a building together. And I'm having fun, but now I cannot go back. I've hired my staff. The AG has signed off on the building. I'm back to put my feet on the grounds to work to make some serious money. I'm sitting up with my legs on the couch, and I get a call and say, you know what, Amanda, we don't want to go with Douglas Elliman. What do you mean you don't want to go with Douglas Elliman? I'm Douglas Elliman. What do you mean? Oh, no, we don't want to go with Douglas Elliman. Duh. But we're going with this other company, and we want you to interview with the other company. So I'm saying, okay, good. Because Douglas Elliman really didn't have any Black folks like me working in the development portion of their company. Mm-hmm. And I think I was too old to work in the development portion of their company. So this is a brand new start for me. I'm happy. So I get all dressed up in my finest Chanel and I go to this company. It was Halstead. And I'm sitting there with the developer's sister and the two brokers, and the head of the development team comes in, looks at her watch like this, looks at me and says, I'm just told about this meeting. I got another meeting. What's up? And I'm saying, wait a minute. This is a scheduled meeting. She sits there for about 10 minutes. And I gotta go. And the brokers, the new brokers, I'm thinking, okay, they had a nerve to say, Amanda, you did a wonderful job on the building. We like the name. So what we'll do for you is you could be the lead salesperson and we'll give you 4% of your deals, talking to me now, and later you can join our company as a salesperson. They squashed me right in that room. So you're talking about $500,000. That's a lot of money, right? That's a lot of money. And you're talking about a long-term goal. And I went home and I was like, oh my God, now what? So I go to my company. I got files this big. We could sue them. The owner of the company was Donald Trump's best friend. Said, no, Amanda, you could sue them, but you got to leave our company because we're not going to sue them. Howard Lorber. He said, no, you could sue them, but we're not going to sue them. But this, no, you could sue them. I couldn't believe how depressed I got until God said, are you stupid? Wake up. Get out of this. Snap out of it. But I could say I saw a shrink because I couldn't believe that you're treating me like family. We're breaking bread. We've been together for 6 years. And then to you, I'm making too much money. That's too much money. So you're just going to say, no, we don't want you to make that kind of money. And for a minute, I could say, I allowed myself to be weakened by someone else. My mantra is, every time that I wake up, God bless me with this day, and I'm not going to fuck it up. That's my mantra.
With that, yes, we're at the end of the road. My guest has been Pucci Amanda Jones, jazz vocalist extraordinaire.
That's it for the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Join us next week for another wonderful episode. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
The Break Store. Unique branded gifts for the holidays, birthdays, or just because. Visit us at www.thebreakstore.com. Hit the right black get in touch button.